From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll look at the looming pension crisis for the city of Milwaukee. Then, we'll learn about a new affordable housing project on Milwaukee's north side.
We all share a common thread of needing safe, quality, affordable housing. And so wherever we can find that need, then you know, we'll work on.
We'll discuss the importance of civility and how it can be achieved through building better relationships.
So a lot of people are very concerned about civility now. They're concerned about a loss of it. They're concerned about recovering it. But why is it so important to people? That's a really good question.
Plus, learn how to make the vegetables grown over the summer last over the winter in our dig-in series. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. We'll start with the events that unfolded Sunday night in Waukesha. A 39-year-old man plowed an SUV into a group of onlookers and holiday parade participants in Waukesha. At least five people were killed and nearly 50 were injured. Young children are among the injured. Several members of the Dancing Grannies group are among the dead. The victims range in age from 52 to 81. Police say the suspect was involved in a domestic dispute before driving into the parade. He's now facing intentional homicide charges. For the latest information about the Waukesha Holiday Parade victims and the ongoing investigation, you can go to WUWM.com and listen for reports from the WUWM news team during Morning Edition. The city of Milwaukee is no stranger to financial woes. For decades, the city has faced budget shortfalls that force cuts to essential services. And although federal funds gave the city a reprieve in its most recent budget, an emerging pension crisis is once again threatening its fiscal security. Pension payments are projected to have a major increase in just a couple years, and the outcome could be devastating to city services. Allison Durr has been covering the pension crisis for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about it.
Right now, what is the scale of the pension crisis in Milwaukee?
The city is facing a really significant pension problem, and it's coming very quickly. In 2023, current estimates predict that the city's annual pension contribution will increase from about $71 million currently to between $145 and $150 million. And then that's expected to remain elevated for the years to come.
How did we get to this point, and why are we seeing it accelerate so quickly right now?
In a lot of ways, it's been a long time coming. So the reason that we're seeing this increase in 2023 is because the city uses a policy in which it resets the amount of its annual pension contribution every 5 years. And that's meant to avoid annual swings in that contribution that can make it really hard to budget year to year. So 2023 is the next reset, and that's why we're seeing this increase. The other reason is because factors including a drop in the anticipated future earnings on the city's pension fund from about 8.2% to 7.5% are also, you know, causing them to then have to increase the amount that they are contributing each year.
So it seems like part of that is due to declining investment returns. Is that accurate?
Yes. Well, it's a difference in how much they're anticipating they're going to be making on the pension fund. So they've changed the assumption, which is what has caused them to then have to put in more funding year over year over this next 5 year span.
As someone who's not really an economics person, looking at these assumptions, what are those assumptions based on?
They're based on a number of different factors, including, you know, how much they anticipate that they're going to receive based on current factors. There's a number of different, you know, number of different factors that go into that, but basically they realized that the higher assumed rate of return was probably too optimistic, and that's why they ended up lowering it.
So who all is impacted by the pension crisis? Certainly people who work for the city.
You know, it's people who work for the city, but it's also residents. I think that's really the key here, is that the pension spike threatens city services that residents rely on. City officials haven't said, you know, how these potential cuts in 2023 would be distributed across departments, but they've used words like draconian and catastrophic. They've described it as a nightmare, you know, if they can't find a way to address this pension spike. You know, a report from the city's pension task force found that a quarter of the city of Milwaukee's workforce could be let go between 2023 and 2025 if this anticipated spike isn't addressed. You know, so it's both residents and city workers who would be impacted by this.
Well, and the idea that these would be really draconian measures, we're already in a landscape in which city services have been cut kind of year after year. Right now, we're actually in a position where we're a little better off in part due to federal funds. But before right now, we've faced a lot of cuts in a lot of different departments. So cutting 25% of the workforce seems like it would be unsustainable. What have public officials said they want to see happen to possibly avoid those kinds of huge cuts?
Yeah, this is definitely something that is on public officials' minds. I think probably with the biggest change that we've seen, or the biggest response that we've seen, has been the 2022 budget, where the Common Council and Mayor Barrett set aside $40 million into the pension reserve. And that would bring that total up to an estimated $82 million by the end of the year next year. And that funding is meant to, you know, help the city kind of ease this increase into this higher contribution so that they're not having to pull that out of the annual budget. I think that was very significant, that $40 million. And, you know, you could see ARPA funds, American Rescue Plan Act funds, used in future budgets as well to try to help at least delay the impact of, you know, of this increased pension contribution. But that doesn't solve the problem. I think the other element of this is that city leaders are, like other leaders in Milwaukee and Milwaukee County, really pushing the state to try to get legislators on board with allowing a sales tax or some other measure that would allow the city to raise revenue in order to kind of help on that end as well.
Does it seem likely that the legislature will respond to the city's requests? Because this has been kind of a back and forth for a long time, the city asking for more power, specifically over sales tax, and the legislature denying that power.
Right. And I think it depends who you ask. You know, some people say that they remain optimistic that the legislature will ultimately step in and, you know, allow either additional ways for the city to raise revenue, or that the state would be willing to send additional shared revenue. You know, others are truly not optimistic about that possibility. So I think that really remains to be seen. It's a huge question mark at this point.
So we're looking at 2023, really, but 2023 comes up a lot more quickly than we might think. What is our real timeline for finding a sustainable solution?
Well, I think the ARPA funds from the federal government have helped in terms of easing that 2023 deadline a little bit, depending on how they're used. And that's a decision that the Common Council and the mayor will be making in the coming year or years, when the second half of that approximately $400 million is received by the city. I will say too, though, that each year, the council and the mayor take up the next year's budget. So when we're talking about 2023, you know, they're going to be dealing with this in the fall of 2022. So time is really running short.
Sure. Well, Allison, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Allison Durr is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the city of Milwaukee's pension crisis. In about 20 minutes, our dig-in series will explore how to continue using local produce, even as the weather gets colder. But first, we'll speak with a Milwaukee native and developer who is working to bring affordable housing to some of the city's most economically challenged neighborhoods. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you drive past 37th Street and Villard Avenue on the city's north side, you'll see some construction going on. That's where Milwaukee developer Q Alamin is building 43 affordable townhomes. He also recently worked on the Community Within the Corridor project, where developers are reimagining the former Briggs & Stratton industrial site into about 200 affordable apartments. But Alamin doesn't want to stop there. He wants to bring economic development into neighborhoods where residents are experiencing poverty at a high rate. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang about his work.
We really wanted to focus on areas that didn't see a lot of development. In recent years, we've seen a lot of housing, mainly in downtown Milwaukee. And we know that we have to help not only downtown, but other areas around the city. The north side has been left out of the development scene for a while, as is the south side of Milwaukee. So we really focused on areas that were up and coming, but also that needed a new development.
And could you expand on that a little bit? What do you mean by new development?
So the development that we focused on is affordable, meaning you should be able to afford it if you have a job, no matter if that's low-paying job all the way up to a high-paying job. So we go from affordable all the way to market rate, and it's new construction or highly renovated projects. So you're really getting a high standard of living. When you walk into the apartment, it doesn't seem as if it's subsidized or less than any other apartments that are built, you know, anywhere in the city. And so that's what's really needed in the communities. Oftentimes, the housing that are there is inadequate. It may have a lot of defects. And so you really want to offer people a great standard of living.
I'm just curious too, how are you able to build these affordable townhomes?
So we're able to build these projects mainly because of the low income housing tax credit program. That program highly subsidizes the construction costs by providing tax credits that a developer like myself would sell to then take the construction costs down. And without these, for the amount of rents that are charged, it would not be able to be built.
So in these neighborhoods that you are building these townhomes in, how are you ensuring that these remain affordable to residents on the north side?
As part of the low-income housing tax credit program, they must remain affordable for at least 15 years. The Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Agency requires them to be affordable for an additional 15 years. So you as a developer already go into a mind state that these will be affordable for 30 years when you build them. And under federal and, you know, state law, they have to be. And so that's the way that it maintains and ensures that it will be affordable for the long term.
What's the reaction been from community members within the area about the development of these new projects that you're working on? What has the community response been?
Overall, the community response has been very well received. People usually like to see development in the area. I think people enjoy that it's not high rent amounts because it does maintain some of the character of the neighborhood. But at the same time, it does invite new people into the area. So if you have a good mix of those, most of the time they're accepted. And additionally, we had a lot of community meetings for both projects to make sure that it was something and we were putting it together as the community wanted. And you know, that's very important.
And you're also in the works of building additional affordable townhomes in other parts of Southeast Wisconsin. Tell me more about this and why in these locations?
We currently have, well, we awarded loan composite tax credits for a project called Bronzeville Estates with Melissa Allen, and also in Two Rivers, Wisconsin, with the West River Lofts. And right now, the developments have been very centered around transit-oriented development, meaning they have access to railways, roads, or waterways. And so that's been the focus, to put housing in places where people can get to other places relatively easy. And so that's really been the focus, and that will continue to be the focus, you know, moving forward. But we want to make sure we're spreading out, you know, what we're doing. We're working on a project in South Milwaukee as well. And so it's a number of different demographics, but we all share a common thread of needing safe, quality, affordable housing. And so wherever we can find that need, then, you know, we'll work on.
And are these projects the same types of developments like what are being built at 37th and Villard? What do these new developments in South Milwaukee and in other parts of the state that you're working on, what do they look like?
They all have their own niches because every community has its own culture, and you want to be cognizant of that culture. So the project in South Milwaukee is a redevelopment similar to the communities in the corridor, but it was a very industrial site called the Cyrus Erie. And so in that development, in addition to the housing that we built, there are also a large amount of manufacturing and industrial use and some office use. So it is a place where you can live, work, and play all on the site. In Bronzeville, those are single family homes. So people have the opportunity to live within their own quarters. They're very nice 3 and 4 bedroom homes that we're offering. So that's, again, a mix of housing, but the premise is the same, but everybody, again, has their own niches, and we try to fit that niche.
When people from the neighborhood see these new developments, there's a fear that of gentrification, or fear of those who are in the neighborhood being priced out or kicked out of the spaces that they live in. From your perspective as a developer, how do you ensure that those who are already living in the neighborhood aren't displaced or aren't pushed out of the spaces that they call home?
That's a heavy balance. A lot of it is finding ways to support the neighborhood and the neighbors surrounding the development as well, so that you're not, you know, pushing people out. And in addition, it's putting affordable housing in places where there will be market growth, so that once it does happen, people who are used to paying those affordable rates still have a place to reside. And so it's no, I guess, one silver bullet. But for me personally, it's identifying places before a huge boom comes, to at least put procedures and people in place so that, you know, it doesn't move as many people as it might have if those weren't in place.
Yeah. And like what you said, it's a heavy balance. From your perspective as someone who is a developer and works in developing spaces, what drives you to keep pushing through with these projects?
Mainly is knowing that at the end of the project, it's going to help or change, hopefully, you know, people's lives. And so that's what kind of keeps you motivated, because it within the communities in the corridor, knowing that you have an opportunity where people can actually go play basketball, futsal, volleyball in the community every day, like in addition to the housing units that are there, but you have a place where it's a daycare there, it's a laundromat that's needed there, you have after school STEAM programming. So you can build this environment that you know is going to make for a better place. And that's what kind of just keeps it going for me. You know, similarly in Two Rivers, this is their first residential development in over 20 years. And so, you know that, again, this is going to motivate someone to hopefully do more, have a better living environment. And so that's what kind of does it for me.
With future projects that are coming up, what are your future goals or what is your next project that you're aspiring to take head on?
A new construction school. And if we talk about, long time, and somebody please email me if I'm wrong. But I think the last new construction school on the north side of Milwaukee was like North Division High School in like 65. I know Hoppa did an addition to their school recently, which was the biggest probably addition to a school in I don't know how many years. But new construction ground up from like a plot, a new construction school, so that when students go to that school, much as I've seen the renderings for Hoppa, much as that, like when you walk in there, when you see it, it's like, wow, I want to be there. I want to go to school because it's just such a cool environment. But we need 100 more of those. And so I just want to be on the forefront of doing that. We'll see. We'll see how it happens. But if there are any developers, women, people of color, Native American, whatever pot you're in that want to work, kind of learn the business, please reach out to me. Because I think adding those perspectives help a lot, because it's going to be something that my experience didn't allow me to see. And so if you're out there and you're interested, please reach out to me.
Q. Alamin is a principal at Scott Crawford Incorporated. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. With Thanksgiving coming up, some of us may be bracing ourselves for dinner table conversations about politics or the pandemic that could turn ugly. UW-Milwaukee professor Bill Keith says it's the relationships we form with our loved ones that can actually foster civility on topics that we disagree on. Keith is the co-author of a book called Beyond Civility: The Competing Obligations of Citizenship. He joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers earlier this year to talk about it.
What do you think civility in general means right now in this moment that we're living in?
I think civility, I can't decide. I've been talking to people about that. Is that there's a project I've been working on for now about 7 years. And did I choose the perfect time for a book to come out or the worst possible time for a book to come out? So a lot of people are very concerned about civility now. They're concerned about a loss of it. They're concerned about recovering it. But why is it so important to people? That's a really good question. And I think it's important to people because we have a political system in which the way we understand that political system is that it works basically through people talking to each other and talking to each other on a number of different levels, right? So you have the debates that happen within the US Senate that's talking. You have the entire media ecosystem in which arguments and ideas and images flow back and forth. You also have the talking that you do with people you know, some of whom you may know a little bit. You may have a conversation with your postal carrier, some people you know very well, with family members about public topics. So the United States, as a kind of democracy, does seem to make decisions based on the outcomes of large conversations. And so if we look at over the last 20 years, the way in which things have changed relative to marriage equality. 20 years ago, it was hard to talk about the legalization of gay marriage. It was difficult. People got angry. It seemed impossible. It seemed like there were legal barriers. And after about 10 years of conversation on many different levels, then it sort of became somehow obvious that this probably was okay and had to happen. Are there still a minority of people who disagree? Of course. There's always a minority of people who disagree, but that doesn't prevent us from actually moving forward. So that's a case where the conversations, the arguments, the flow of discourse, mostly civil, sometimes a little bit less, did seem to make a positive change. But now we're in a period of time after 4 years where we feel like this is spiraling out of control, that somehow talk is actually working against us and it's not productive.
I think that gets to this idea of civility, the necessity of it, but also the limitations of it. We're living in a moment where people can't agree on basic facts. People can't agree that, the grass is green, as it were. How do you use civility in a situation where just the core principles of people seem to be so divergent?
So I want to reframe that a little bit and make it a more general point about the way that we look at public discourse and government as well. So a lot of times people say, oh, government is terrible. Politicians are terrible. Surveys have shown for decades that people say politicians are terrible and dishonest and greedy, except for mine. The person I elected, they're great. It's just everybody else, right? So there is a bias built into the way that we talk about this. When people say they don't like government, they're usually talking about the latest drama at the national level. They're not talking about their local government, which may actually work pretty well. So when you say we can't agree on basic facts, actually we mostly do agree on basic facts. So there is this moment we have in all the agreements that we have about how things work and how stoplights work and all this stuff, where certain things become politicized. I think we can agree on the color of the grass. That will work. We can't seem to agree on masks, even though a lot of people think that's pretty much as factual as the grass. So then the question is, okay, you have these pain points, these problems where things are heavily polarized, heavily politicized. And that is where it's difficult. And so you're calling in civility to solve the problem, which in some ways has moved past that. But of course, the point of civility is to try to maintain enough of a relationship with people so that you can actually disagree with them. And this is one of the things that we talk about in the book, is the difference between weak civility and strong civility. Weak civility is behaviors and norms that sort of maintain the appearance of ease and comfort and belonging. And this is equivalent to just strategically ignoring things that are difficult. So when people say, okay, at the Thanksgiving dinner table or whatever, we're not going to talk about politics or religion, that's weak civility. So people, in a sense, are being civil. They talk about the weather and sports and other things, but they don't get to places that are hard. A democracy requires strong civility, which is a set of behaviors and norms that allow people to disagree and disagree deeply. And so what's lost right now is the feeling that we're able to do productive disagreement. So a lot of the things end up people shouting, you know, their own truths at each other without actually engaging each other. And of course, social media is a huge complication to the entire process.
Social media is especially the place that I think a lot of people encounter this. You know, getting back to this idea of just core facts, we witnessed an insurrection at our nation's capital that was inspired by groups that believe, and this is going to sound bizarre, but believe that many politicians and major media figures eat babies. Although it might seem fringe, I think a lot of people are dealing with people who believe these things in their normal life. We just saw many of them attack politicians or try to. Is civility what we use in that moment, or is civility divorced from that?
So in general, I think when the violence begins, you've crossed the line and civility is no longer the thing which is in play. The point of civility is to allow people to disagree without it turning into violence. And so once it turns into violence, you've left that place, right? Because in America, for the most part, we don't use violence for political ends. We don't solve political problems through assassinations and bombings. Now, conspiracy groups, conspiracy theories are not new to the U.S. They were part of the founding. In the middle of the 19th century, there was the Know Nothing Party, which was basically a white supremacist conspiracy party in which they didn't want people to actually realize what they were about. So if they were asked about it, they would say, I know nothing. And that's how they earned that name. In the 1930s, we had on the radio a new technology at that time, Father Coughlin, who spread anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, in particular cast at President Roosevelt. So these things we've had all along. So the question is, like, what's different now? People have always been able to get together and talk about their ideas, some of which, as you say, are fringe, some which seem ludicrous, but obviously they take them quite seriously. Civility is a kind of relationship with people. So if you have this relationship, then you're able to do disagreement with each other. You're able to critique each other's ideas and arguments without breaking the relationship. Social media does not foster those kinds of relationships. Social media relationships are incredibly shallow, right? So people read posts, they click like or dislike, they share things on Twitter, they don't share things on Twitter. Twitter and Facebook are set up to make money. Every time someone clicks, somebody gets paid. The things that make people click tend to be the things that make people angry. Extreme emotion is what drives those. Now, when you think about civil relationships, especially in the sense of strong civility, they're not typically driven by drama. You probably know people in your life that you've had long-running arguments with about what is the correct shape of government, or about a specific policy, what should we do about immigration or prison reform or whatever. And you've had this disagreement and you've gone back and forth over maybe many years. That's a strong relationship. That's a relationship of strong civility. In strong civility, you should also be able to call people out. Civility is coming together as civil society, making people uncomfortable and doing the right thing and yelling at people who are not doing the right thing when you have to. The possibility for loud disagreement is built into civility, but it really can't cross the line. And part of the problem now, too, is that the way in which we have understood our public relationships, we used to think, you know, we're all in this together. We're two different parties, but we're all Americans. We share U.S. history, et cetera. But now people are starting to get into relationships with each other where they say, well, no, we have the real truth, and those people aren't Americans. They're not just wrong. They're evil. People, you know, they have their own kind of media consumption, and they've gotten interested, and they've read a bunch of things that have led them to think this certain thing is very plausible, and you find it ridiculous. So, okay, how do you engage that, right? You, in good faith, find it ridiculous. They, in good faith, find it plausible. So what do you do about that? How do you talk to a flat earther or an anti-vaxxer? Or I want to say that if you think of it in a sort of a close confine there, I'm just talking to this person who I otherwise don't know about this one difficult hot button issue, you're really not going to get anywhere. Civility is not your friend. Civility is a network of behaviors and norms in a relationship over time. So you really have to ask yourself, what is my relationship with this person? And have I laid the groundwork to be able to have this kind of disagreement with them? Is there the trust there that we could actually listen to each other? Because, of course, you find what they're talking about ridiculous, but you should be, on the grounds of strong civility, listening to what they have to say as well, right? And not starting from the position that, well, I'm right and they're wrong, and so how do I get them to believe what I do? That isn't actually very civil. So it's probably true that what you need to do is begin building relationships with people on things that you do actually agree about. And there's a lot of stuff you do agree about. Because, of course, it's much easier to have policy arguments when you already agree about 95% of things. It's harder to do it when it's only 70% or 50%. But for most people, there are a lot of things that they do agree about. There's values that they share in common, and those become points for moving forward. Does that pre-exist the conversation you're having? Probably not. So you have to do the work to develop it. Whatever that background of agreement is that allow you to move forward, you have to work on that and you have to keep working on that, right? It doesn't automatically come. And so it's sort of deceptive. You can watch certain kinds of talk shows on TV where everybody's basically in the same place and they have these conversations. They're really interesting and really interesting arguments and the way they use evidence. But that's a kind of artificial situation. The ones in our daily lives typically aren't like that.
What is the end goal of civility?
It is keeping the dialogue going. It's keeping the discussion alive. Part of the way that we think about democracy is that so the people decide. People don't decide blindly. They sort of decide on the basis of these ongoing long-term conversations about things. So if you go back 100 years, first you have the creation of the income tax, then you have the reforms of the New Deal. These were the result of people talking about things are broken and they need to change. There was a lot of discourse during the 1930s about how did we end up here? What is so broken? What do we need to change? And that provided the basis for accepting many of the reforms that Roosevelt had. So the thing is not that we should all end up agreeing. Because at a certain point, but also not that we should understand ourselves as winners and losers, that we evolve better and better policies. Basically, the way liberal democracy seems to work is that we see a set of problems, we try solutions. Solutions have their own weaknesses and problems. We try to address those, and so on, right? There is no point at which we get a perfect government, a perfect set of policies, or that we all agree. We should have disagreement. We should have people poking holes and making objections because that improves our chances at doing this kind of problem solving. But right now, it's very hard to do because in the public sphere, people seem very dug in and they seem, especially if you're on social media, more interested in yelling at each other and calling each other names than in doing anything that's helpful.
Well, Bill, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
My pleasure.
Bill Keith is a professor in the English department at UW-Milwaukee and the co-author of Beyond Civility, The Competing Obligations of Citizenship. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in March. We'll take one more break and then return with our dig-in series with Venus Williams. We'll look at the many ways to use local produce this fall and comfort food to get us through the winter. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Most of us have already put away our gardening tools for the season, but there are still great ways to get fresh, local produce and continue using it throughout the winter season. Every month, Lake Effect's Joy Powers is joined by Venus Williams, the executive director of Alice's Garden, for our series called Dig In, which is all about gardening and healthy eating.
You know, this time of year, things are really settling down. I think a lot of people go, well, you know, the gardening season is over. I'm going inside. But there are still ways that we can continue to, in some ways, interact with our gardens by utilizing the bounty of the harvest.
Indeed. This is the time of year where we really can appreciate the local farmers in our area who have grown an abundance of vegetables and fruits that we are able to still access when our smaller gardens are done. So I really love this time of year to think about all of the beautiful root vegetables, especially, and the greens that our local farmers have available and that we can access through some local markets, such as the Milwaukee Winter Farmers Market, which has moved down in the Deer District at Gather. It is there on Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. So it's early, you get in and out, you're not fighting as much traffic as you would later on in the day, but you can still access apples and carrots and onions and all of those wonderful fresh products. Then there are places like Turtle Creek Gardens in Delavan. It's one of the rare farms that has an autumn and a winter CSA. So their CSA goes throughout the entire year. They are a beautiful whole systems regenerative farming farm. Don't be fooled by the word gardens in their name. They are a full-fledged farm. And if you go to their website, turtlecreekgardenscsa.com, you will be able to get on their email mailing list, and they can tell you when their farm store opens for each month, what you can order, and they deliver. And I love it when Turtle Creek Gardens, when Janet the farmer brings me my sweet potatoes and onions and garlic in January. It is just the most nourishing thing. And then lastly, and I'm sure there are others, there's a new market in the Port Washington area called the Dream Port Harvest Market. It's on Franklin Street, and it too is open on Saturdays, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And once again, you can access sustainable farmers and their products and their value-added products. So there's no need to mourn that you will not be able to get the fresh food that you need come December and January.
Well, and there are a variety of ways that we can really make this produce last through the winter and ways that don't really incorporate refrigeration. I know a lot of us have very limited fridge space, right? We're trying to make things last, though. How do you do that?
I really would like to encourage people to consider root celery. So I'm going to actually introduce a book right here in the middle and another one at the end. One of my favorite books is Root Celery. I know I say I always have a favorite book, but I do. Root Celery, Natural Cold Storage of Fruits and Vegetables. It's by a couple by the name of Mike and Nancy Bubel, B-U-B-E-L. And it is an amazing, straight to the point book that really looks at how you store, how and where. And then it gives recipes and so many other things. A lot of people think that, oh, I have to build out this incredible root cellar. And no, if you have any unfinished area in your basement, we have a room that was added on to our home that we can turn the heat off in that particular room and store all of our leeks and onions and squash. I encourage you to, when you go to your local farmer's market, or if you still have access to your farmer, to not just buy what you need for that week or the next couple of weeks, but to consider creating a small root cellar in your home. Once you do it, you will be totally hooked. You will expand it. Don't call me and blame me when you turn one whole room into a root cellar, but it really is a great way to have local food all year round. All of our ancestors at some point either stored in this manner or stored, created root cellars literally by digging holes in the ground and storing vegetables within the earth.
And a great eco-friendly way of preserving food.
Yes. I don't do a lot of canning. I do a lot of freezing, which kind of leads us to another conversation with that. Right now, especially in my garden, I still have lots of collards and mustard and kale greens. And what I will begin to do is harvest those, because we all know, or maybe we all don't know, that once that frost hits a couple of times and they're really tender, oh my gosh, that's when you really want to cook them. I do harvest my greens all season long, but they taste nothing like they will taste as I harvest in November and December. So another way to preserve right now is to go ahead, I will cook my pot of greens fully with all of the seasonings, and I will freeze them. I will put them in our freezer and I will label them for the holidays, for the birthdays. And so when the time comes, I still get to pull out a big freezer bag or two of greens that I cooked in November, but that we're sharing for our Easter dinner or the February birthdays.
Well, and that transitions pretty well into the next point of our conversation, which is looking at recipes. We're getting into the holidays especially. People are looking for comfort food as things are getting colder. What are some great recipes that use the bounty of our harvest?
There are so many. We will need to have three segments to talk about this. But since we have one, potatoes and leeks, onions. I love potato kale soup. Potato, kale, and leek soups. This is soup season. This is pot pie season. We are in casserole season. And the earth has provided right now in this moment all the things that we need. So as we look at squash, which is something that you can store in a very safe, protective way, you don't even need a root cellar because of that hard outer core. Acorn squash is one of my favorite dishes to prepare within these next few weeks and couple of months, to just go ahead and split open that acorn squash. You might have to cut the tip off a little bit so that it can be safely on a baking shelf, on a baking rack, and just add in a little bit of butter, a little bit of cinnamon, maybe some brown sugar, and go ahead and cook that. Put that spoon in later and just really enjoy it. The same can be said for so many of the root vegetables that are available right now. So we're looking at beets, we're looking at carrots, we're looking at Brussels sprouts. To go ahead and get those fresh veggies from your local farmer or your local organic store, you know, co-op, and roast away olive oil, your favorite seasonings, put them in that oven at 400 and just let them roast. Roasting really packs in and keeps the flavor of those vegetables in. So we don't lose not just the flavor, but the vitamins and minerals. A lot of times we overcook our food when we boil on top of the stove. But by putting it in the oven and roasting, we really are sealing in not just flavor, but also all of the benefits of those vegetables. We also don't want to forget about salads. A lot of people don't think salads this time of year, but all of these vegetables make incredible salads. Now we know potato salad, whether we're having it cold or whether we are having it warm, like a German potato salad. But when I think about going ahead and using all the different cabbage that is still available and making a 3 or 4 cabbage slaw, that's really good. When I think about doing a salad that has all of the microgreens, so a lot of our farmers and growers and ourselves, we're doing microgreens now. Go ahead and use those microgreens, and we can't overlook arugula during this time of year, which makes an incredible salad, and they're so nourishing. One of the simplistic ways that I teach about greens, especially for me, is it tends to be the darker the color, the more nutrients, the more of a power green. And of course, there is spinach. And you see, I'm on a roll. We have to talk about casseroles. Oh my goodness. So one of my favorite casseroles to make, and I don't make it often enough, but this is the perfect time, is an onion casserole. You might say, yeah, no, it's delicious. Whether you're doing a sweet onion casserole, I like to do an onion casserole that really takes advantage of the variety of onions that are available. So a 5 or 6 onion casserole as a side with some cheese, great seasoning, you will be surprised. You might want to add that to your holiday dinner. Try an onion casserole. And of course, we can't miss out on our fruits, our apples and pears. We have some incredible orchards here in the state of Wisconsin. And go ahead, get those apples fresh for your apple pies, for your apple and pear crumbles, for all of those desserts that we really, our body begins to crave during this time of year. The wonderful thing about getting those apples directly from the grower is that they can really tell you about the variety of apples and which ones are best for a pie, which you should use if you're making applesauce. I'm excited about this time of year, and I'm really ready to nest and to come into our home and to really have it smelling good with this bounty from local Wisconsin farmers.
Oh, for sure. Now, we've already talked about a little bit of reading, but we have another book that we're going to look at this month. What do we have?
I have this huge tabletop book called Potato and Rice. It is still available on some sites because I went to look, but it's Potato and Rice, the definitive guide to preparing and cooking 2 all-time favorite foods. Although it is a potato and rice book, it really incorporates a lot of the harvest right now. The potato and the rice dishes are paired with those green vegetables, the soups, the casseroles, the desserts, the breads, looking at the different kinds of breads we can make based in potato and rice breads, rice cakes, all these wonderful varieties. So Potato and Rice, it's by Alex Baker, Sally Mansfield, and Kristen Ingram. But even if this particular potato and rice book is not one you can get your hands on, there are so many wonderful potato and rice cookbooks. Go ahead, nestle in. It's okay if we add a little bit of poundage during the winter. We will work it off. We are mammals. We'll work it off come spring and summer. But really, I invite you to enjoy the hard work that our farmers have done all season long as we move into these autumn and winter months.
All right. Well, Venus, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing these recipes and your work.
Thank you, and happy eating to us all.
Venus Williams is the executive director of Alice's Garden, and she joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers every month for Dig In, a series all about gardening, herbs, and healthy cooking. You can find some of our previous conversations at WUWM.com. And that's Like Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of the conversations today on the show, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Just search for Like Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Like Effect Spotlight. You can also hear this episode again tonight at 8 o'clock here on WUWM. Tomorrow on Like Effect, we'll hear some of the latest Listen MKE discussion on the trial for Kyle Rittenhouse and how the acquittal is impacting people of color in Kenosha. Plus, talk with the founder of Milwaukee Mothers Against Gun Violence about her work. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.